Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of JTalk Extra Time. I'm John Steele, and for this first period of the show, I'm joined as always by Stuart Smith. Hi Stuart, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you John. I've just about dried out from all the rain on the weekend, but yeah, I'm doing well,
yeah.
Thanks.
Good. Yeah, I think we're going to talk about the weather more than usual in this week's first period, I think, Stu. Just to surprise you, the listeners, and keep them on their toes, we're actually going to talk about J3 in the first period of the show this week. And we're going to get to J2 and talk about all the J2 games from the weekend in the second period. So for our first period, Stu, we're going to be talking about J3. I'm repeating myself already. Round 12 was played over the weekend, but fewer fixtures than usual because the weather played a pretty big role, didn't it? Thunderstorms meant that the matches between Toyama and Hachinohe on Saturday, and perhaps more importantly, at the top of the table, the match between Gifu and Akita, scheduled for Sunday, were both postponed before kickoff. And I think that makes Gifu a very rare club of teams having two fixtures affected by weather in a row, because the game that they were winning 2-0 away at Fukushima in the previous round was abandoned at half time, wasn't it? So what was your reaction to that news coming through, Stuart, about the Gifu game being postponed, and how do you see the fixtures sort of piling up later on in the season now?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think on Sunday, up until around 4 o'clock, it was blazing hot sunshine. I think it was around 36 or 37 degrees in Gifu. But yeah, then the weather forecast kind of showed a big kind of storm cloud heading down from the north. So obviously it traveled down from Toyama the previous day. And then, yeah, everybody was looking at the radar, and the clouds were edging closer to Gifu itself. And when it did start raining, it properly started raining. And I think the original kickoff time was 6 o'clock, but then it got moved to 6:30, and then it got moved to 7:30. But I think just before 7:30 that they made the decision to call the game off. Very disappointing. I think that Gifu would have been well up for this, and it would be kind of one of the highlight matches of the year. And now they've got a slight issue with scheduling now. One game, yeah, you can, the J3 schedule is a bit lighter than the J2 schedule, so one game off is something that you can get over, even if it is an away trip to Fukushima. But now they've got another game to add in somewhere along the line, and yeah, it's gonna be a little bit of a scheduling hazard going forward. I'm not sure that Akita are gonna be too impressed coming down to Gifu again. I think it's gonna be a tricky game for them. I think that, yeah, having weather-related issues for two games in a row is something that I've not really come across before. And just like a heads up, the Gifu are hosting YS Yokohama on Wednesday night, and the weather forecast is rain storms again, so we might be revisiting this situation again. But yeah, not an ideal scenario for either game, really, Gifu against Akita or Toyama and Hachinohe.
I suppose we have to accentuate the positive. Gifu certainly won't have many tired legs for that game on Wednesday, because they haven't kicked a ball, you know, since half time of the Fukushima game. So there might be a silver lining to go with the rain clouds. That's terrible metaphor.
Well, I think also that the postponement meant that Gifu were winless in August.
Yeah, considering how many rounds of games there were as well, that's not a good.
It's not a good start, is it?
Yeah. Do you know what? I wonder as well if for Akita, the last couple of games they have looked leggy. They looked a bit tired. I think you're totally right that they wouldn't have enjoyed schlepping down to Gifu and then back again without actually playing a match. But in terms of just giving the players a chance to rest and recuperate, that might not turn out to be the worst thing in the world. You know, as long as they can reschedule the game, you know, at a good time for both teams. So yeah, these postponements left us with just seven games on the J3 slate, Stu, and it was Kumamoto who took full advantage of this, the Gifu and Akita postponement. They moved into second place, beating Numazu 3-0 away. Brace from Kaito Taniguchi, taking him to 8 goals for the season, and a goal for Hayato Asakawa coming on off the bench. So 3-0 win for Kumamoto away at Numazu. Now that means Kumamoto only 3 points behind Akita. Obviously, Akita having the game in hand at Gifu. But yeah, Kumamoto are ticking along very nicely. And for my money, probably the best team in the division. I know that sounds a bit strange because they're not top. And Akita are, but in terms of which team I've enjoyed watching and been impressed with, I think it's Kumamoto for me. What say you, Stu?
Yeah, definitely in agreement there. And I think that they're more expansive than Akita, and I think that leaves them open a bit more. And that's probably the difference between the two sides. Akita are very, very organised in their 4-4-2. They're very solid down the spine of the team, and yeah, they're not going to kind of, I was going to say blitz anyone, but that wasn't a pun. But you know what I mean, they're not going to kind of overwhelm teams. Whereas Kumamoto, they're very, very much focused on their attacking play and their wing play. Taniguchi's having a barnstorming year, like you said, 8 goals so far. And not bad for a winger and an inverted winger at that. We spoke in the last J3 pod about how he plays on the left and cuts in on his right foot. Both of his goals on Saturday came like that. They came because he drifted in from the left-hand side. And it's kind of difficult to defend that, because once he does cut inside, then as a defender, usually the right fullback would be tasked with marking him because he's nominally a left winger. But once he cuts inside, you have all those issues of does the right back follow him? Does he pass him on to the centre back? And then like what happens in that time between the passing of players? And he takes advantage of that. He's pretty accurate in front of goal, and he's a cut above the rest of the players at this level. I think we spoke a little bit before in the green room, and he's arguably the best player in this league. He's definitely one of the top two attacking players. I mean, you can make an argument for Yudai Tanaka, the goalkeeper at Akita, to be the best player in the league, Han Gohan, those kind of players. But going forward, and he's just the perfect player for Takeshi Oki's system. Like you couldn't design a better player. And I think that it's a marriage made in heaven. Like Oki will give him the space and the tactics that allow Taniguchi to flourish. So yeah, it's not a surprise that he's doing well. Good to see Asakawa Hayato come off the bench as well. He's a very kind of he's a bit of a joker in the pack. He comes on and he's all energy and he's all action, and he never gives defenders a moment's peace. Roasso, I personally think Roasso are the best team in this league. It's touch and go. They're two very different styles, and I know Akita have already beaten Roasso this year, but just from the way I watch football and the way that I see the teams play, I'd say Roasso are the best team in the league at this moment, but they just have to keep it running, and more performances like they had against Numazu will do them no harm at all.
Mm-hmm. I think we sort of decided before the pod that our team of the season so far in J3 is Akita's back five and Kumamoto's front six. So I think I tend to agree with you. I think certainly going forward there are. They've been very difficult to contain, haven't they? They do have that tendency to kind of grab goals almost out of nothing, if you like, with players drifting in off the wing. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see over the next sort of, you know, 10, 15 games, the rest of the season. Looks like a really good kind of tussle at the top developing between Akita and Kumamoto. So yeah, we'll watch with interest. Now, Tottori, Stew are down into third place now. They've fallen 2 points behind Kumamoto after drawing 1-1 at home to Nagano, who stay fifth. It looked like Nagano were going to take all 3 points here. They went ahead with an absolutely fantastic goal from Kanta Makino in the 74th minute, but Tottori then brought their veteran Brazilian Fernandinho off the bench in the 78th minute, and he headed an equaliser less than 60 seconds later, his first goal of the season. And we kind of pronouncing, you know, we're emphasising the heading because we checked. He's very short, isn't he, Stu? So it's kind of surprising to see him popping up with a header, you know, on the edge of the six-yard box. But yeah, Tottori 1, Nagano 1. Did you see much of this game? You see the highlights of this game?
Yeah, I did. You're right to flag the goals. Like Nagano's goal was a beautiful strike. He might have been the best goal of the weekend. Cutting in from the left-hand side and curling it into the top corner. I like how goalkeepers, just when they're beaten by a goal like that, they still find someone to shout at. Why didn't you close him down? Yeah, well, he's just struck a 25-yarder into the top corner. There's not really a lot that people can do about it. But yeah, like Fernandinho, imagine getting beat in the air by Fernandinho. To be fair, he was completely unmarked. I'm not really sure how that happened. I think I actually thought he was the smallest J-League player. But you found out that he wasn't. In fact, Chanatip, we think Chanatip is the smallest J-League player.
Well, I think what we can say, our research on this has been cursory, I think.
Yes,
it's fair to say.
Yes.
We know that Chanatip at Sapporo is smaller than Fernandinho, but we don't know if that makes him the shortest. I think Fernandinho, 161 centimetres, does it say, in the Mekan?
So, yes.
Chanatip at 158. If anyone can tweet at us, let us know. Any J-League players smaller than 158 centimetres, we'll retweet you and make you famous, yeah.
Can't be. But, yeah, I think it was... If you take aside the fact that it was a Fernandinho header, think that These two teams are decent without being kind of overly good, I think is the kindest way I can phrase it. They're both, and the goals were pretty good quality. I think Tottori might have won it in injury time. I think Joe Anderson, that's one word, not a guy called Joe Anderson. I think he put one just wide with one of the last kicks of the game. It looked entertaining from the highlights that I saw. I think both goalkeepers made a couple of good saves. It wouldn't surprise me to see these two teams kind of close to each other come the season's end. I wouldn't expect them to be third and fourth, but you never know in this league, I suppose. But yeah, a relatively kind of entertaining game, and a couple of memorable goals to kind of add to that game. That sounded an odd.
Yeah, it was a good match. I think entertaining without being, you know, the quality moments with the goals weren't there. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Outside that was an entertaining match. Yeah. Okay. Other games then, Stu. Fujieda stay fourth after winning their third game in a row. This time it was 1-0 at home against Kagoshima, who were down in ninth. Fujieda 5 games unbeaten now, so I think that pretty much makes them the form team in the division. I know I accused them of being inconsistent a few pods ago, so I think they were obviously listening and took note. Now, the winner came in the very first minute of the game from Ryosuke Hisadomi, but in truth, based on the highlights I saw, Fujieda were absolutely rampant and could have probably got into double figures of goals here if they'd been a bit more clinical in front of goal. So Fujieda beating Kagoshima 1-0. Elsewhere, Imabari in sixth place won 1-0 away at Iwate, which was their third defeat on the spin. Jun Arima scored the winner in the 16th minute for Imabari, his first goal of the season. A penalty after a handball from Iwate's captain, Shun Morishita. I think Iwate had a really good shout for a penalty in the first half as well in this game, but nothing was given. And kind of the hot tempers continued in the second half. Imabari's coach, the Spaniard Luis Planaguma, was shown a yellow card for arguing with the referee about a strong tackle late on. So Fujieda beating Kagoshima 1-0, Stu, and Imabari winning 1-0 away at Iwate. What did you make of these games? Anything to pick out?
I think Imabari kind of getting interesting now. I know they. We spoke last week about them signing Leo Mineiro from Okayama, but have they also brought in Sawakami from Seretse?
Oh, Seretse, yeah.
Did I see? Yeah, I must have seen him somewhere. So they've got some decent attacking options now. I think they'll have the odd game where they kind of show their inexperience. But I mean, they've got the second best defensive record in the league. Oh, they're not kind of like blasting anyone away. But I think the signings of Sawakami, Leo Mineiro as well, give them a little bit more, a few more options up front. So I think Imabari are looking quite interesting. And I think that we said in the preseason pod that they were the most important team in all of the J League this year, because we really want to see another regional team, but a team that has kind of good backing and good ideas. Like, we want to see them kind of progress. And we are seeing them progress. They're doing probably a bit better than I thought they would do. I didn't think they'd struggle a lot, but to see them up, what are they, joint fifth? That's something that I probably didn't expect of them this year. I think their Spanish manager, I think he, when he's not punching dugouts and losing his shit on the sidelines, he's doing really well. And I think he's probably getting a little bit of help from above. Not God, Takeshi Okada is probably helping him a lot, steering him through some of the more delicate issues of Japanese football, so the scouting side and that kind of stuff. Imabari are doing well, and I think it's a good story, and I think it's kind of it's important for them to carry on and kick on. I don't think they'll trouble the promotion places, but I think it's a good story for the J League that Imabari are doing well. And Fujieda, yeah, they should have tonked Kagoshima. They should have hit like five or six against them. I think Tsugutoshi Oishi had an off day in front of goal. That doesn't happen very often. But they are kind of menacingly placed in fourth place. I think once they... I think they've got the potential to really kind of challenge the top two. I think Fujieda are better than Tottori, just because I think they will, when everything clicks into gear, they are very, very difficult to play against. And they have good strikers at this level and good supply to the strikers as well. Their Achilles heel will be their defense. I'm looking at the table now, and like, aside from the usual suspects at the bottom of the league, they've got a really bad defensive record. They've conceded 20 goals so far. That will be their Achilles heel, but it makes for entertaining football, and that we should be all glad for some entertaining football, I think.
I think just sticking with my sort of Frankenstein theme of combining Akita's back five and Kumamoto's front six to make a sort of J3 super team, you could probably get some excitement if you put Imabari's back five and Fujieda's front six together. I think you might solve some defensive problems and have a few more goals in that team. But obviously that's silly late night talk. I think on Imabari, for me, they do have some similarities with Akita, so bear with me. But basically, their formation is a pretty no-nonsense 4-4-2. You sort of know what you're going to get. But within that sounds like criticism, but it really is a case of well-drilled players sort of kind of knowing their jobs to some extent. So I actually think I think I'm totally in agreement with you about Imabari, that I don't think they're upwardly mobile you know, in terms of the top two this season, but definitely in terms of just being very well organised and tough to break down, as you mentioned, that goes a long way at this level particularly, I think. They've got a very different approach to Fujeda, because Fujeda's lineup is always shown on the graphic as this kind of 3-3-2-2, but it doesn't look like that actually in play, you know, during the game. It's a lot more fluid than that. Yeah, it's interesting to see different styles, you know, contrasting styles, but both having a good, you know, good results. So yeah, two teams, you know, over the next few rounds to watch out for, I think. Okay, other games then. Stu, Sagamihara are in eighth place, but they went down 3-0 away against Gamba Osaka under 23s at the weekend. Dai Tsukamoto gave Gamba's youngsters the lead midway through the first half. Sagamihara were furious, and probably rightly so, not to be awarded a penalty for a handball in the second half. And then this game got weird in second half stoppage time. Gamba scored two more goals on the counter attack, you know, so it finished 3-0. The scorers were, of course, Shoji Toyama, 8 goals for the season for him, and Shuhei Kawasaki, 6 goals for the season. Two players who I'm really looking forward to see, you know, where they end up next year, or even if they are involved in the first team at Gamba in J1 in some capacity. 4 matches unbeaten for Gamba's under-23s now. They're going well at the moment. What do you make of these two players in particular, Stu, Toyama and Kawasaki? And they've impressed us, I think, pretty much every round this year.
Well, we often talk about them, and so I think that they passed the eye test. And like in the same way that spoke about Kaito Taniguchi, like he looks a cut above the opposition when he plays. These two players, Kawasaki and Toyama, they just look good. And I think that I think Kawasaki's a bit more versatile. I see him pop up kind of in quite a few different places, whereas Toyama is your archetypal striker. I mean, he plays up front on the last defender. He thrives on either balls over the top or balls through the channels. Whereas Kawasaki is a bit more, I think he's a bit more creative. I think he likes to drop off a little bit more. You can sometimes find him on the left. You sometimes find him on the right. And he's a good goal scorer. But he's also a good creator as well. And I think, yeah, just like you, I don't think he'll be in this under 23 team for long. They both passed the eye test, and they're doing really well at the minute, Gamba under 23s. They were slightly, I don't know if they were unlucky not to get a win, but they certainly matched Akita when they went up there last week. And yeah, they've just got some good players, and they again, their Achilles heel is their defense. But at the same time, I think the thing with the under 23 teams, I know we've spoken about these like quite a lot, but I remember when Gifu manager Stravgod Zmenovic was talking about Gamba's under 23s. He said they're a very difficult team to play against because they've got no pressure. Like they're not like their target is not this league. It's actually a different set of goals that they play to, as opposed to other teams in the league. Now, of course, they want to go out and win, and of course they try their best to win, and they're doing really well. But they've got a different kind of mindset. Their mindset is, we need to get into the top team, and they're a very difficult team to play against because they don't have a lot of pressure on them, I think. And I think that kind of thing shows, and it's almost a cliche of like youthful exuberance and that kind of stuff, but when you have that kind of carefree attitude, and I don't know if it's instilled in them from either Miyamoto from the top team, or their own manager, or whoever, but they seem to have this carefree attitude that they have to go out and show what they can do, and regardless of win, lose, or draw, it's more about how they present themselves as players and about how they kind of put themselves in the shop window for the top team. And I think you saw that a little bit, and I think you've seen it recently as well. Obviously, they had a 5-5 at YS Yokohama. They had the 1-1 draw at Akita, and they had this win against Sagamihara. The two goals in stoppage time were really good goals as well. They're really well taken. Mm-hmm. Toyama just smashed it past Victor. You don't see that kind of too much.
No,
they're playing really well, and it'll be interesting to see how long they can keep these players at this level, or whether they get called up for the top team anytime soon.
Yeah, good stuff, and it's really I think something that we do see from Gamba's under 23s, but also Cerezo as well. I mean, I think we're in agreement as not really liking having the under 23 teams in J3, you know, proper. Because they're not senior teams, or they're you know, it kind of makes the league seem a bit like a sort of experiment rather than a fully fledged league. But seeing like very young players enjoying the football, I think is really important. Like, you know, I think you get the pressure as you get higher up is obviously there, and you know, winning is everything, and you know, it can be very stressful. So I think seeing guys just enjoying playing the game is something that we need more of, probably this year more than any other, to be honest, with everything else that's going on. So that probably is putting pressure on the young guys. Like, please enjoy your football, help us out. But we'll talk about another under 23 side then, Stu. It's probably a pretty neat chance to do so. Cerezo Osaka under 23s, they lost 2-1 at home to Fukushima United at the weekend. Very open game, this, Stu. Loads of chances for both teams, especially for Ismaila. For a while, it seemed like a kind of sort of personal duel between him and Cerezo's goalkeeper, Anjun Su. Now, Cerezo thought they'd won this one. They took the lead in the 87th minute with Shota Fujio beating Fukushima's debutant goalkeeper Kim Min-jun. Fukushima's regular goalkeeper Akira Fantini was rested on the bench for this one. In stoppage time, though, things got crazy. Ismaila went clean through to level in the 93rd minute, seventh goal of the season for him. And with the very last kick of the match, the 95th minute, Masaki Ikeda grabbed the winner for Fukushima. So that game finished 2-1. I know you watched some of this game live. What did you make of it?
what can you make of games like this? It's like we said about Fujieda, should have really put Kagoshima to bed. The amount of chances that Fukushima had in this game before Cerezo scored was crazy. And I know that I'm kind of a one man Anjun Su, kind of Cerezo's goalkeeper, like criticism machine, but he played really well in this game. He made two or three really, really good saves to keep Fukushima at bay. I know Ismaila hit the post. He should have kind of he flashed one just wide, and I think Anjun Su saved a couple of his shots as well. And so when Fujio scored, and we talked a little bit about the boys at Gamba doing well, this boy Fujio is a really good player as well. He's been kind of bang on form this year. I think the goal he scored against Fukushima was his sixth of the year, possibly. Whenever I've seen him play, he's another one that kind of pops off the screen. He looks really good. And I looked at it and I thought, well, I mean, that's the ultimate smash and grab. Even though Cerezo were at home, they were completely outplayed, but they didn't take any of their chances. However, it all changed in additional time. Obviously, Ismaila kind of had to be on the score sheet because that's what he does, and that's what he's paid to do. And then right at the end, I think Cerezo, I can't remember who the person or who the player was, but dispossessed probably halfway inside his own half, ball got played clean through, and Ikeda just kind of kept his cool, really good finish. Left Anjun Su flat on his back, and as soon as the ball went in and as soon as they started celebrating, the final whistle went, and it's a bit sad for Cerezo, but I don't think anybody who looked at this game or who watched this game could kind of argue with the end result. Like, this was a game that Fukushima completely deserved to win, and yeah, it came in a roundabout dramatic way, but the result is a legit result, and yeah, probably something that is quite welcome for them, given that they were 2-0 down at halftime last week. They probably needed a little bit of a pick-me-up, and yeah, this game provided it.
Fair enough. Yeah, all good points. Another fun meta game you can try if you're watching Seretse Osaka's under-23s. I don't know if you were doing this like I was, Stu, but looking at their squad numbers, it's always a pretty interesting one. I know they had a goalkeeper on the bench with shirt number 1. That was Takumi Nagaishi.
Mm.
But the rest of the team, I mean, it's hard to believe they've really got this many players. But number 53 in the starting lineup, number 54, 55 on the bench. Pretty sure, I don't know what the highest total of shirt numbers, if you added them all together, is in J-League history. But Seretse must be pushing it this season. I looked at Gamba's, for balance, I looked at Gamba's under-23s. And I think they're usually got players in the 30s. In terms of squad numbers, but yeah, 50, 55, 56. There must be no room in the changing room at the training ground. It's just players, you know, wall to wall players, if they've got 56 people with a squad number.
Well, Gamba's under 23s. I don't think they have names on the back of their shirts. I could be completely wrong about that, but I kind of get the feeling that they don't have names on the back of their shirt, whereas Seretse do. So each person's shirt is individual. I just wonder, yeah, that might be. Well, we're going through a few niche points tonight, John, like heights of players and that kind of stuff. But yeah,
just something in the air, you know.
Yeah. We're delving deep into
this. This is what happens when two games get cancelled. When two games get cancelled, this is what happens. Yeah,
we have to pick up
slack.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, they do have like a huge. I mean, what was their lowest squad number starting? 27. Jesus.
They had 24 on the bench, but numbers 2 to 23 not represented at all.
It's like an American football team.
It's. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, pretty crazy shit, Stu. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Okay, talking of crazy, Sanuki nearly picked up their second win of the 2020 season, but ended up drawing 1-1 at home to YS Yokohama. Now, Kazuma Takagi put Sanuki in front on the hour mark in this game, but YSCC made a double change in the 88th minute. Taisei Kaneko and Jorn Pedersen coming on. This paid off in the 5th minute of stoppage time when Kaneko crossed for Pedersen to head home an equaliser. For Sanuki, they're obviously going to be disappointed. They seem to concede quite a lot of late goals, don't they? But they're unbeaten in 3 games, so signs of life for them. And for YSCC, a team that usually is winning or losing, they've drawn 4 in a row, which is pretty surprising stuff. We should also point listeners in the direction of Chris, Lost in Football Japan on Twitter. He's got a really good video up at the moment of YSCC's last home game, which was against Tottori in the previous round, which is worth checking out. So Sanuki 1, YSCC 1. Stu, I think you're on record as saying you think Sanuki are a bit of a better team than they've shown so far over the first 12 games. What do you think of this game?
Yeah, it's getting... like every week it's getting a bit more difficult for me to justify that. Like, you can only be unlucky up to a certain point when you're conceding goals in the 93rd minute, and it was a good header from Pedersen, but he was completely unmarked, and to leave a striker completely unmarked on the 6-yard line in the 3rd minute of stoppage time when you're leading 1-0, that's amateur mistakes, I'm afraid. And that's probably why they're second bottom of the league. I think they are better than second bottom of the league, but they're just not showing it right now. I mean, they've only won one. I mean, they played really well in their previous game when they won at Hachinohe. I don't think they played as well in this game. I think it's kind of difficult to play that well when they're playing on a pitch that looks like shit, basically. And yeah, it's just that The only thing in their favour that I can really think of is that, aside from Takagi Kazumasa and the goalkeeper Kenta Shimizu, they're a very young team. But then so are YSCC, and like they have a little bit of direction about them. They have an identity. It's just not clicking for Kamatamari Sanaki at the moment. And yeah, it's just, they should have won this game. Not to put too fine a point in it, they should have won this game, but they didn't. And there's a lot of games like that that they've had this year that they should have taken something from, but they didn't.
I think you, yeah, and I, we both support relatively unsuccessful teams back home in the UK, don't we, if we're honest? And there does come a point every season where you just realize it's not going to be our, it's not going to be our season. This is going to be a bad year. And I think for Saniki, I feel like they've had so many of these late equalizers or nearly games that I think, yeah, conceding a fifth minute equalizer to YSCC is probably the point where you think, hey, it's not our year this year. It's probably a good year not for relegation, not to be a thing. But I agree with the point you made. Lots of young players, and I think they're almost at the point of now. Saying that you're going to plan for next season after 12 matches is defeatism that even I'm not prepared to entertain at this point. But do you know what I mean? It's almost, yes, as if, like, okay, well, we're 30 points off, well, off automatic promotion. We can start to think more long term or medium term at least.
Well, the thing about it is, like, I can understand that point of view, but just the fact that there's a lot of loan players, and just the financial aspect of this year means that, my guess is that at the end of this year, there's going to be an awful lot of movement. You might get teams that, like, shuffle the deck completely. Like, I know Morioka, before this year started, they had 16 new players and they let 20 go or something like that. It's all very well saying you're going to plan for next year, but if the plan doesn't involve the players that you already have at your disposal, then I would think that it's a wasted exercise. I mean, I think they're in between a rock and a hard place, because they're not going to get promoted and they'll be lucky to finish in mid-table, but at the same time, they don't really have a lot of assets at the club, and the good players are either old, like Takagi Kazumasa, or they're on loan. And so that makes me think, like what exactly is there, is their plan? What is their blueprint going forward? How do they envisage their club operating? Like, with YSCC, it looks like they have a plan. They might not execute it on a regular basis, but they play young players. The young players like playing in an attacking system. It showcases them. They move on to different clubs. Rinse, repeat. And then you build up, like, a reputation of, oh yeah, I'll go and play at YSCC because the manager's innovative. They're attacking, and I'll get the chance to showcase my abilities. That's what I can see from YS Yokohama. With Kamatamari Sanaki, I get the feeling that it's a club lost, basically. I don't really know, and that sounds really harsh, and I don't feel good about saying that, but I just wonder what the point of Kamatamari Sanaki is, to be honest, at this moment in time. Now, maybe it's just it might just be a reaction to how badly they're doing this year, but again it's not just them. I mean, they've got Imabari like 20 minutes down the road from them, creating a lot more buzz, looking a lot more organized, having a lot more backing, and that kind of thing, it's got to impact them. And I wonder where Sanaki, you know, like in interviews, like like if you go for a job interview, the interviewer will say, well, where do you see yourself in 3 years, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I'd like someone to ask Kamatamari Sanaki that. Where do you see yourself? What do you what do you envisage bringing to the J League or bringing to your kind of surrounding area? Because I can't see it at the moment. That sounds really harsh. I'm sorry about that.
Well, yeah, but I think you know that we reach a point where being harsh and being realistic is pretty much the same thing. And I think with Saneki, we see that they've sort of blown the head start that they had on Ima Barry and Ehime, I think, to some extent, really, in terms of, you know, developing a fan base or a successful team. The problem that you've got is that I think, just to counter your point about the number of loan players, they do have a couple of good, exciting homegrown players, isn't it? Mark Ajayi Kurita, for example.
Yes, that's right.
But if they do well, then they get sold, right?
Exactly. So they just leave. They don't even get sold. They just leave.
I think I'd be phoning up maybe Mito or Yamaguchi and asking them how they go about, you know, setting up a whole new team every January to see if I could get some ideas. But I think my point is flipping, but it can be done. You know, you can sort of get a team together, every 12 months. But I think Saneki just in danger of drifting, aren't they? You know, 14th place finish last year. At the moment, that would look like a pretty good result for this year.
Yeah.
But I think I agree that the frustration is, I watch their highlights in a huge stadium, this cavernous bubble, albeit with a terrible pitch.
Yeah.
And I think there is, like, with so many teams in Japan, there's potential there. And I mean, you know, I'm not a sports business. Don't really have a sports business head, so I'm not really sure how that could be realized. But yes, I think it's frustrating maybe when you see teams like YSCC who there's no reason why Saneki couldn't emulate that. We'll see, time will tell. But I think we're definitely looking at probably another season in the doldrums and another year kind of lost, if you like, for Saneki this year. We'll try and end on a bit more of a positive note. I think after that sort of bleak dystopian vision of Saneki's future, where they're just a feeder club for Ima Barry. But so to get us revved up, there's a midweek round, full midweek round in J3 this midweek, as we've mentioned, round 13, Wednesday, the 2nd of September. This is where the fixtures start to come thick and fast, and my hair starts to fall out even more than it does already with stress. But basically, something to watch out for with these Wednesday games, Stu, we have a couple of these tricky afternoon games, don't we?
We do.
Because of the lack of floodlights at some of these grounds. So Hachinohe should be hosting Seretse Osaka's under-23s at 2 p.m. On Wednesday afternoon. You've also got Fukushima, who'll be welcoming Gamba Osaka's under-23s at 3 p.m. Another 3 o'clock game is, I think, quite an enticing looking one. Ima Barry hosting Nagano, 6th versus 5th in the table. Then we have at 6 p.m, kind of more traditional midweek time, I suppose, Akita hosting Numazu, 1st place versus 11th. Akita should be well rested after that postponement with the game at Gifu last weekend. All the other games are at 7 p.m. We have Sagamihara against Saneki. Toyama hosting Kumamoto, 7th place versus 2nd place, should be good. Gifu, as we mentioned, hosting YSCC, probably in the rain. Toppuri against Fujieda, also at 7 o'clock, 3rd versus 4th. And we compared those teams a little bit in the pod today, so it'll be interesting to see who comes out on top in that game, if anyone. The last game on the slate, Kagoshima hosting Iwate. Which is your pick of the midweek games, Stu? And I think I'm down to do the midweek mini pod roundup. Where should I be focusing my gaze, do you think?
Yeah, well, you've got a lot of good games to choose from this midweek. I think, and probably Toyama Kumamoto. I think that'll be a really decent game, actually. It won't finish 0-0. I'm pretty confident in saying, unless it's postponed again, which we don't want. But I think that'll be two decent attacking sides. We've already waxed lyrical about Kumamoto, but Toyama have recently kind of kicked into gear a little bit with their attacking setup. I think that'll be a good game. I think Tottori versus Fujieda, like you mentioned there, 3rd versus 4th, I think that'll be a good game. Yeah, Imabari Nagano as well, you highlighted that one. I don't expect an expansive game. I expect a pretty kind of close for encounter there. Yeah, there's some good games on the schedule. I think Akita should be thankful that they're hosting Numazu, because I think they'll I don't think Numazu will trouble Akita. But yeah, there's some good games. Should just say as well, like the 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock kickoffs, Wednesday isn't a public holiday in Japan. It's a usual school/work day, so I'm not sure how many people will be through the gates for those particular games. But yeah, some afternoon games but a good slate of games in the evening as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good midweek round, weather permitting. I know we have a big typhoon passing through the kind of Okinawa region for this week, so there is some rain kind of schedule for the mainland as well. Hopefully that doesn't interfere too much with the matches in midweek. But yeah, is there anything else we should add, Stu, before we depart?
No, I don't think so. Like, just I think it's gonna start shaking out as it's meant to be, the table in the next few weeks or so. Like you said, we've got another set of games coming pretty thick and fast on the back of these ones. This is where suspensions will start to kick in as well, and injuries, tiredness, and that kind of thing. And I think we'll get to see over the next kind of 2 or 3 weeks, we'll get to see kind of who is genuine about kind of sticking around the top of the table and who isn't. I think we've got quite a bit to look forward to in J3.
It's good to hear. Yes, Aniki might even win another game between now.
Hopefully they will.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the analysis as ever, Stu. It's always good to get together and chat. Hope the listeners enjoyed the show as well. Thanks as ever for listening and downloading. If you're a Patreon as well, we appreciate your support over on the Patreon. That helps us to keep going, keeps the lights on and the microphones on, and my air conditioner as well, which hopefully isn't too abusive in the background. Stu, where can people catch up with you on Twitter if they want more of this sort of thing?
More of this? There are people who want more of this? Is that what
apparently,
you're saying? Yeah. Oh, crikey.
In my family, there are people who want less. So just law of averages. There must be people who want more somewhere else.
In that case, at @sushi_football for more of this, basically. More of this and more weather forecasts, I think.
It's all good.
About you? Where can people find you?
Yes, thank you. Yes, as always, at J2 Canto Bites on Twitter is where I do most of my socials. Not as frequently as I'd like, but whenever I can. So yeah, please give us a follow or say hello, especially if you know any shorter players than Chanatip in the J League. We want to hear from you. Okay. All right. Well, yeah, everyone enjoy the midweek round, and we'll be back with midweek mini pods, I think, for J2 and J3, and a full kind of weekend roundup as well, probably about the same time next week. So thanks again for listening. Enjoy the football, and bye for now.